let's open the House Committee on Land Use. Today is February 5th, 2013. It's exactly 3 p.m., regardless of what that clock says. And we're going to go off the agenda right off the bat, because that's the way this whole session is going to be in this committee. It's going to be exciting. No one's going to know what's going to happen. The speaker's going to be down here a lot. Ramona's going to be down here a lot. And start with introduction of committee members, even though there's supposed to be some other stuff on the agenda first. But I want everybody to know who everybody else is. So why don't we start down here with Representative Unger.
Representative Ben Unger from House District 29, Western Washington County.
Anything else you want to tell us all?
No, I feel pretty good about that. I mean, that was
it's a solid trivia.
I was going for brevity.
It covers most of the bases.
Yeah. First and last name.
Yeah, that's good.
Representative John Davis from House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, King City, all the way up to Hillsborough. And my bit of trivia is that my son just turned one on Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday. So we had a joint one-year-old birthday party / Super Bowl party, which was not what my wife was hoping for.
Kind of mixed. There's no alcohol for the one.
But we enjoyed it. The guys enjoyed it.
You're not going to wear one of those Sherwood hats again, like your predecessor. You wear a Sherwood Forest hat around. Please don't do that.
I'm a proud supporter of the Robinwood Festival.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's true. You have who's got the Verbort Sausage Festival?
Oh, that's me.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. I also represent Verbort and Roy.
Who was his predecessor?
I don't remember.
Oh, okay.
Representative Kevin Carpin from South Salem, Almsville, Turner. And I'm on this committee because I'm interested in what happens to my garden.
And let's go down here. I'll come back to myself.
Would that be me? I'm Lou Frederick, state representative from District 43. That's Lloyd Center, north and northeast Portland. Lloyd Center, Emmanuel Hospital, Concordia University, and PCC Cascade, and trivia. Trivia? I have way too much trivia.
The White House thing we talked about earlier. Yeah.
That was, I have been, among other things, a television reporter, a teacher, a public information director for the Portland Public Schools, a ranch hand, and a mime. So
did you say mime?
I said mime.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So I have a bit of a range, and I have a background in molecular biology as well. So
Director Whitman is going to be doing miming in his
no.
He's not a director anymore.
No
he's
reason
an
to do
advisor
that.
Or something.
No reason to do that. But I've got a chance to do a lot of different things, and I'm looking forward to this committee.
All right. Representative Thatcher.
I am glad I'm on a fun committee with a sense of humor to keep us awake at this hour. But after committees, I don't know. Kim Thatcher, I come from Kaiser, but I represent Kaiser on up to St. Paul and Newburgh. And, trivia. Well, I have a little 5-week-old grandson who is absolutely adorable. I can show you all pictures.
I was going to say.
That's it.
It's in OLS already, I
there,
saw.
Yeah, I, yes, I did upload that earlier.
Representative Paul Holvey from District 8, South Eugene, Alvador, Elmira, Veneta, Notai, Walton, Crow, and Lorraine areas, and some areas just west of Cottage Grove and Cresswell.
And I'm Brian Clem from here in Salem. The Capitol now ends up in my district. Representative Cameron, Vice Chair Cameron, excuse me, oh my goodness, he got some of my southern edge and I encroached further north to take in the downtown of Salem, along with Central and East Salem, and lots of people out east of Salem who don't live in Salem and they don't want to be annexed, FYI, just for everybody who is interested in that issue, really don't want to be annexed out there, everyone, don't really try it, this is the Land Use Committee, we don't do that here. So anyway, with that, we need to move into the having some rules, which is an unfortunate circumstance when you thrive on chaos, but apparently we're told we have to. So I'm looking for a motion on some committee rules, and then we'll have an explanation of what these few changes are from previous sessions.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 5th, 2013.
Pseudo-Vice Chair Davis... moves the committee rules be adopted, dated whatever date that was. Day was that?
Today. February 5th. Yeah,
today. Today, February 5th. So before we get into committee member discussion, well, Lynn, you didn't introduce yourself. Well, how about right in the middle of the rules? Could you do that real quick?
I'm Lynn Beaton. I'm the committee administrator, and with that, we're moving on.
Got nothing else, really?
That's okay.
Nothing
Thank
personal
you,
at all, really? Okay, that's fine. So could you tell us about the changes? You've probably heard about these in your other committees potentially by now, but if not, there's a few changes from what we typically do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee rules are modeled after the chamber rules. They're identical in each committee for consistency from one committee to the next. There are three primary differences between the previous rules and these. First, references to dual leadership or co-governance have been removed. Second, concepts expressed in a minority report must be raised during the discussion of the underlying subject. And the third is that there is an entirely new section added to the rules dealing with declaration of conflicts, which states that members must announce conflicts prior to voting in the committee, the same way you do on the floor of the chamber, and that you must provide a written statement of the conflict to the committee assistant by 5 p.m. of the next business day.
Okay, discussion on the rules?
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Well, I just want to declare a conflict of interest.
In writing or verbally?
Well, I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay.
Because everything we do here as citizen legislators is potentially a conflict with things we face out there.
We could keep the whole timber economy going if you just, everything you could possibly think of, if you'd furnish in writing to Mr. Arrington by the end of the, by 5 o'clock
it's
today.
It's in the garden.
So, any other discussion? Considering I voted against the House rules, it was 59-1. Thanks a lot, all of you, for helping me. I was thinking about voting against these, but that would probably be a bad sign, so I intend to support these rules as well. Yeah. Okay. With that, no more discussion. We'll ask for any objections. I won't do the roll. Any objections? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. This committee can now function. So, we did our introductions. The we have one committee measure called LC 1166. Do they have a copy?
They, yes. Mr. Chair,
as you probably know from your other committees, there's a request from a committee to introduce a committee bill, and no way obligates you to support it at all. It's just somewhat of a courtesy to allow it to be introduced as a committee bill. If you want details on this one, I can give them to you. If you don't, then we'll either hear it or never hear it. I'm not sure, to be honest, but it's the one committee bill that I've got going, given I didn't know this committee would even exist at the time. So there's lots of House Ag committee bills floating around over there with nobody in charge of them, but this is all for us at the moment. Anybody interested in... Okay, then. Representative Unger,
Chair Clem, I move that LC 1166, dated 12-7-12, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Unger moves that LC 1166, dated 12-7-12, be introduced as a committee bill. Any further discussion other than that, again, this doesn't mean you like this bill at all?
Well, just
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Just making a note that I don't see it on OLIS, or the, you know, the online system for...
I've heard there were some kinks today still.
Yeah, well, I don't see it, so I actually haven't even seen it to even raise an objection, but I can give you one if you like.
There's a paper copy there.
Oh, there's a paper copy, okay.
So I'm very pro-paper copies. I don't really like the electronic one. Yeah, exactly.
There we go. All right.
So having not seen it, is there any objection? Again, no obligations to vote for the bill later. Seeing none, then the measure is introduced as a committee bill. And I will, I didn't even open a work session. I wasn't even in a work session there. Can I open a work session retroactively? Okay, we're fine. Closing the work session that I didn't open. Now we're going to get into where the adults come up and run the show.
What's that?
You're going to
get
removed. Yeah, I know. I was fishing for a visit from somebody upstairs. So, Richard, are you starting? Jim, who's, please, the director of the... Department of Land Conservation and Development, accompanied by the Natural Resource Advisor to the Governor. Please join us, and I know you've got a little slideshow introduction. You want the lights dimmed, maybe?
As long as people can see, I'm fine, because I have this in front of me.
Oh, yeah. Did you upload it into OLS? You did, actually. I saw it. That was pretty smooth on your part. It's brownie points for you. Okay, please begin.
Okay. Chair Clem, members, for the record, Jim Rue, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm going to do a few minutes of an overview on the state's land use planning system, Land Use 101. We'll try to get through this in about 12 to 15 minutes, and then Richard will spend a little bit of time talking about some of the metrics by which we measure success and help point us in the direction of where we need to head in the future. Very quick history. I think you know probably all of these gentlemen. A couple of them came from this body. But we will in May be celebrating the 40th anniversary of the passage of SB 100 and SB 101. So obviously Governor McCaul in the middle, Hector McPherson, state rep on the left, a dairy farmer from the Corvallis area, and Senator Ted, why am I blanking?
Halleck.
Halleck, thank you. The co-sponsors of the measure. Lots of words, but what I think we want to take away from this slide is two bills, SB 100, SB 101, and the point of them is that the intent is to coordinate planning between cities, counties, and the state, and to make sure that it is comprehensive. And so you see the word comprehensive on about the eighth line down. Comprehensive meaning that in this state, we don't do environmental impact statements for anything other than federal projects. And so that when this system works, when cities and counties in the state are aligned, we essentially set the table for projects ahead of time so that we should have the industrial land set aside. We should have plenty of housing. We should be ready for what comes our way. Obviously, that's the ideal. But when it works, land use at the center touches all of the issues from economic development to housing to transportation. What we'll probably spend most of the time talking about today is protection of our natural resource legacy, the farms and forests. So when SB 100 was passed in 1973, it created at least three things. The first was our commission, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, comprised of seven members, a variety of professions, a variety of backgrounds, a variety of geographic representation. So we have people from all over the state. We have people who are sitting county commissioners, past city councilors, past state reps. In fact, of the seven, three of our members are former state reps. We nearly always have a farmer. We nearly always have a Portland developer. And we try to make sure that we touch most of the interests that somehow come to bear in land use planning. The department is the essentially the staff for the commission. The planning goals, of which there are 19, and we're not going to go through all of these one by one, but they sort of fall out into categories. The first one is always citizen involvement. Planning in this program starts in cities and towns with communities or with community members and planning commissions working together to eventually come up with the plans that are adopted. Goals 3 and 4, and again, that's where we're going to be spending most of our time, are preserving working ag and forest lands. goals 9 through 14 pretty much refer to what happens inside the urban growth boundary, making sure that we have vibrant and livable cities. And then the last four, 16 through 19, relate to the near shore and territorial sea. Our commission, just a week and a half ago, passed the first planning effort in the territorial sea, one of the first in the country. So I want to spend just a couple of minutes on this slide because this talks about how the system works when it works well and works right. And I mentioned just a minute ago that it starts with cities and counties. Cities adopt their own land use plans. They do need to be consistent with the state goals, and they need to come up with regulations that allow them to administer those. The last thing that they do, of course, is the most important thing, and that is meet their citizens across the counter at the planning department, and it is there that they get the applications that they either approve or deny the specific request. All of that rolls up to state agencies. We have interagency agreements with probably 25 state agencies, and we work particularly with Richard's guidance. The Natural Resources Cabinet has about 14 natural resource-based agencies. We meet twice a month, and this is where we spend our time, making sure that we're all generally headed in the same direction. The roles for LCDC, adopt and amend statewide goals and rules. This was not a one-time issue. Once they were adopted, every one of these goals has been amended over the years. The commission also sits in review to make sure that urban growth boundary submissions, large UGB submissions, and periodic review conforms with state guidance. And the last one, approve all original land use plans. Our 243rd city, our newest city of Lapine in Central Oregon, just south of Bend on 97, was approved by the commission last summer. So their comprehensive plan was adopted and became the newest city with a plan in the state of Oregon. I think we've already talked about this next slide, and so I don't want to, in the interest of time, I want to go over it very quickly, but it does focus on the role of the county. If most of the planning happens in cities, then the county deals with those areas outside of its cities, but it also, under current law, coordinates population forecasting, approves UGBs that come to that come through cities to the counties, and works on estuary planning. So, obvious slide of the day. We know we have a diverse state. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time in the remainder of this conversation trying to disabuse you of the notion that this is a system where one size fits all. I think, in fact, we have done quite a lot in terms of regional approaches to land use planning. But first, just setting the stage. More than half, 55, nearly 56% of the private land in the state is in working agriculture. About half that amount working forests, a mixture of farm and forest land, rural development, smaller lots scattered about. But again, I think the takeaway here is that less than 3% of the state is within the UGB. Richard probably has the number, but that the number of the population of the state within the UGB is probably easily into the 80s. And so that leads us to the mission.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Three things. Sorry. Yes, please.
Ask a question. So the numbers you just put, can you go back to the slide there just real quick?
Yes.
So I understand that slide. Is that just total private land?
total private land.
Do you know what the correct total acres of the state is? So what percentage of the
we're
state is private land?
Public, Chair Clem, Rep. Cameron, total public land is probably 30 million acres, thereabouts, about 52%.
Yeah. Thank you.
So this is just slightly less than half of the total land base. So three things, moving now to the department and what the department tries to do with this legacy. And we're bolded for the three things: to help communities and citizens plan, to foster sustainable and vibrant communities, and to protect our natural resources legacy. Areas of focus, and I'm going to go through this very quickly because I want to spend a little bit of time on the next slide, but citizen involvement, protection of ag and forest lands, urban development, we've talked about it. Some of the challenges, population growth, development pressures on farm and forest land, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. It is the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and so we have been working very hard, particularly in the last several years of the economic downturn, to get shovel-ready land ready and available for development. We've talked a little bit about climate change, and citizen involvement is always on the list. So, I mentioned just a few minutes ago, excuse me, Territorial Sea Plan was approved by the Commission. We've mapped the entire 1,200 plus square acres of the Territorial Sea and set aside less than 2% for the development of wave energy. And so there are four sites, starting at Camp Rylea in the north and going down to Lakeside in the Coos Bay area at the south end, that are set aside for proof of concept and basically pilot scale development of ocean energy. We don't expect that we'll ever see utility-scale ocean energy development in the Territorial Sea, but we have made a provision that Oregon can be among the leaders in the world, let alone this country, in the development of that new technology. Large lot industrial employment in Central Oregon. We have recognized, some would say perhaps late to the game, that not everybody lives in the city that they work in, or not everybody works in the city that they live in. And so the three counties of Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook are working together to define a universe of seven industrial sites that are regional in nature and will be replenished as they are used up. There's a 10-year period of time where we'll take a look back and see what worked but what didn't, but it is the first regional industrial plan in the state. Jackson County just approved what is sometimes known as their regional problem solving or their regional plan that plans for a doubling of their population in 50 years. And that was just approved this summer. Metro Urban and Rural Reserves was also approved this summer. Richard will probably be spending some more time talking about the Urban Forum. This highlights the places where we think we can do better and where we're spending some time, and you'll undoubtedly hear about some proposals that we have on how to improve the way the system works. And climate change. We are working with voluntary efforts in communities throughout the state to try to address a reduction of greenhouse gas, production of greenhouse gases from transportation, and looking at alternatives, particularly in metropolitan planning organizations, trying to look for alternatives to the gasoline-powered engine or the single-occupant vehicle. Forest land, why protect it? I haven't looked behind me in the last few minutes, but I would guess that Doug Decker's in the room, and we'll be talking about this a little bit. we have done an extraordinary job of preserving forest land in this state from over the last 35 years. But there are real threats. There are real threats to the ownership of large tract industrial forestry. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it, but it is key to the industrial base in many parts of our state, but particularly on the dry side, on the east side of the Cascades. We are in some of the finest farmland in the world right now. And particularly in the Willamette Valley, we've done an extraordinary job of being conservative in the way that cities use up land. That is, we're not taking land commensurate with the growth in population that you would find in other parts of the West, and certainly in other parts of the country. 98% of all non-federal land in forest and ag in 1974 is still in working forestry and ag, and Richard will talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Having said that, there are some real challenges. Challenges to what we do about pressure on ag land, how we think about uses, not just on wineries. We've spent a fair bit of time talking about uses on wineries and activities on wineries. But as ag, particularly in the central part of the valley, starts looking at value-added products instead of shipping out commodities, that means that in many cases their business model depends upon the fact that people in Salem and Portland and elsewhere get in their cars and drive to the farm. And at some point, all of that cumulative effect starts having consequences for neighboring ag and neighboring uses of other kinds. And I'm going to close with the last two slides. We'll certainly in the next few weeks and months be talking an awful lot about UGBs because we have some proposals to bring to you. But we can only preserve resource land if we are conservative about how we expand urban areas. We can only have productive, vibrant communities if we have productive, vibrant resources. The two of them work together. It's conservation and development. Sometimes it's conservation by development. But the two of them work together. And so the takeaway slide here is that we have to absorb population growth conservatively, and we need to conserve our working farms and forests. And with that, I'm done. So any questions?
Questions for Director Rui now?
Yeah, that's
okay. You get another shot at him after after Richard, probably, if you want.
Representative.
Wait, I just had one question.
Yeah.
Just how often does the commission meet?
Chair Clem, Rep. Thatcher, six times a year. We usually, or the commission usually, meets for 2 days at a time. And the schedule is January, March, May, July, September, November. About half of those meetings are out in the community, and about half of them are here. So this year we'll be in Baker City and Tillamook. And because of session, we'll have four meetings here in Salem instead of three.
Follow-up. I was just asking, so I was just looking at the public meeting notices, and I didn't see any for 2013, so I just, that's why I was wondering. I don't know why they're not posted, but there wasn't anything posted for January either, so that I could see. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong spot, but a bunch for 2012.
I'll try to answer that at some other time.
That's okay.
Okay, anybody else at the moment? Mr. Whitman, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resources Policy Advisor. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you at the outset of the long legislative session here. And I really look forward to working with you, Chair Clem, and all the members of this committee on land use issues. I know land use certainly has a reputation as being a contentious area, one that gets very complicated and frustrating and a lot of conflict between stakeholders. And We have been spending quite a bit of time in the last year working through with stakeholder groups some of the more difficult issues, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more at the end of my presentation. I made Director Rue go through all the dry stuff, just descriptive part of what the Oregon Land Use Program consists of. I get to do the fun stuff. And the fun stuff consists of taking you back up to a 30,000-foot level and talk a bit about how are we doing. We're 40 years into a statewide land use program. Is it being successful or not? What are some of the metrics? So I'm going to talk about five general areas. I'm going to talk about efficiency of growth and as Jim Rue said, part of the purpose of the program is making development work, particularly within urban areas. I'm going to talk about rural sprawl, cost of growth, and conservation of land for ag and forest industries. Okay. So first I'm going to talk a little bit about the efficiency issue. And so if you look at the national numbers, the population of the U.S. has grew by 17% from 1982 to 1997, while the land area of urbanized areas grew by almost three times that much. So you had a much greater rate of growth in urban land area than you did in urban population. Oregon was the exact reverse of that. Our population grew by faster than the national average at 37% over that time period, while the land area for our urban areas only grew by 3%. I'm going to get into, we've been doing some work, particularly with the Oregon Department of Forestry, but also with 2010 census data, to look at this question of how is Oregon growing over time. Obviously, we've had a lot of population come to the state in the last 40 years, and the projections are that we'll continue to have a lot of population migration to Oregon. So how are we going to deal with that? Where do all those people go? So this shows that for, and this is census data, 2000-2010, the population in Oregon has grown by about the same rate as the population in Washington, while our urban land area has grown by about only 75% of the rate in Washington. So our population per square mile is increasing at a faster rate, again, this is in large urban areas, than in any other state in the Northwest. I won't comment about Idaho. Similarly, if you look at the number of people that are accommodated for each acre of land that gets urbanized, the first number up there for Oregon is the number before land use planning. The second number is after land use planning. So you can see that there's about a fourfold increase in the number of people that we are accommodating on each acre of land that we urbanize. Finally, again, for large cities, 86% of our large cities over 20,000 in population, have had an increase in their population density over the last 10-year period from 2000 to 2010. Washington was a little bit behind that, Idaho way behind it, and California in the middle. So that's sort of a big, quick overview on efficiency of growth. I want to just have one or two slides on rural sprawl. So in rural areas outside of city limits, you'll see that from 2000 to 2010, the population in Oregon in those areas actually went down. The number of housing units stayed flat, no change in housing units during that 10-year period. Contrast that with Washington, you had a 6.2% increase in housing units, even while you had a decrease in population. Those are, you know, largely retiree second home construction occurring in rural areas. So the takeaway message is Oregon's land use program has been successful in conserving ag and forest lands from rural residential development. So why is efficiency of growth important beyond just protecting the agricultural industry and the forest industry? Well, there are very real dollar and cents consequences for local government. And this slide is based on a study actually from the Minneapolis urban area, but there are about 15 similar studies from around the country, and they all show more or less the same thing, which is the bottom line. Infrastructure cost in urban areas for an urban level of development, 5 units to the acre, that's sort of your typical small city level of development, is less than half of the infrastructure cost for a more typical rural residential type pattern with a home on a half acre lot. So for cities that are looking, and counties that are looking at long-term fiscal effect of growth, it's really important, the land use program, by concentrating development within an urban growth boundary, has had a significant cost savings for local government in terms of reducing costs. That's also true on the revenue side, if you think about it. So obviously, as you have a greater concentration of development within a particular area, you're going to generate substantially more local property tax revenue than if you have a very dispersed development. So it is in local government's direct financial interest to have growth occur within urban growth boundaries and not occur in rural areas. I want to come back and talk about land conversion now for the agricultural industry. Why do we care about agriculture? Chair Klim, I think, yes.
Representative Worley has a question.
Thank you. I have a question just before you move on away from that point about urban development. In our land use goals is to try to make that growth happen within the urban growth boundaries as much as possible. So do we have good policies and land use policies involving the development of that land inside urban growth boundary? And by that I mean, are we able to develop that land within the urban growth boundary, and how do cities provide those services? Where does the policy for cities and annexation come together with urban growth boundaries and trying to protect our forest and farmlands?
Chair Klim, Representative Holvey, I don't know if the chair set you up for that question, but I'll try my best to answer it. So the thrust of the land use program is to assure that once an area is within an urban growth boundary and planned for urban development, that development actually occurs without being blocked through land use disputes. The idea is once you have the planning in place, the permitting process for development to occur should be very straightforward, frankly much more straightforward than it is in other states, both our neighbors to the south and north. That's the 180-day rule requirement that local governments act on development permits within a set amount of time. But the rest of your question had to do with getting urban services to areas once they are brought within urban growth boundaries. There is a requirement in existing law that there be agreements between cities and districts regarding who is going to provide what service to in what areas. Those are so-called urban service agreements, and that's existing statute. That has been honored a little bit more than half the time if you look in different local governments around the state. And in many circumstances where you do have urban service agreements, they have not been updated regularly. So we are getting into a situation increasingly where you have not had the discussion at the local level about who is going to serve areas that are brought into urban growth boundaries. And this is the source of much conflict, not all the conflict, but much of the conflict that you heard in the last session. One of the things that we have been working on for the last year is a proposal, part of the legislative package that the Department of Land Conservation and Development and the governor are putting forward, is some new provisions on urban services agreements to straighten out that, I'll just be frank and call it a mess. We, at this point, do not expect to be proposing changes in annexation policy. That's a different question. But if we at least can get agreement regarding who's going to serve particular areas, that's half the battle right there. The annexation issues are tough ones. We've got a situation where we make land use policy that says this is going to be an urban area, but our annexation policies don't necessarily align with that. That's a long-term conversation that needs to happen in this body, needs to happen with the citizens of the state, that we don't have an easy solution to. But it is something that needs long-term attention.
Thanks for that.
Yep. It's probably more than you wanted, but anyway.
No, just right.
Got to work on those urban service agreements.
Okay.
Yep.
So why do we care about conversion of ag land? Ag is the number two industry in the state. It's 11% of the state's employment base. It's one of the main traded sector industries in the state, which means it's bringing new dollars into the state from agricultural production. Oregon has been much more successful than just about any other state in conserving ag land. You see the numbers, I won't repeat them, but you know, many other states have lost 10, 20, 25% of their agricultural land in the last 40 years. Oregon has not. Same thing for forestry. Forest products industry is number three in terms of economic output in the state. It is extremely important in particular parts of the state where forest products is a very high percentage of the economy and the employment base in particular counties. So even if it's not as big a number statewide, it has very important local effects. So Oregon has 99% of the forest land base that it had in 1630. So we have lost almost none of the forest land base. In fact, I was looking at data regarding the overall stocking of forest land in western Oregon. We actually have significantly more timber on the ground right now in western Oregon than we've ever had historically. And that, some of that has to do with federal forest policy. Some of it has to do with our land use system. There are also implications in terms of development on forest land in terms of fire costs.
Do you have any proposals for us to get back to the same percentage of private forest land ownership in 1630 for today?
You want to take that up with the federal government, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, area of critical concern over all federal lands or something like that, maybe.
Chair Clem, be my guest. All right. So just some quick numbers. These are in your packages. I'm not going to go through them in detail. This is just documentation. Oregon versus Washington. These numbers are based on work done by the Oregon Department of Forestry that looked at not changes in how lands are planned, but changes in how lands are actually used. So these are on-the-ground numbers regarding how land use has changed in Oregon and Washington. Very interesting comparison between the two states. This is over the long term between 1974 and 2009. The next slide shows the more recent period. You'll note the numbers drop for Oregon. In the last 15 years, we've gotten much better about conserving farm and forest land than we were in the early part of the program. Okay, so basic result is that we've been very successful in conserving farm and forest land, which are key inputs into the agriculture and forest industries. This is a map that shows the land use change over the last 40 years. You'll note the interesting part of this map in my mind is the green squares. We actually have had an increase in agricultural land in north central and southern Oregon as a result of bringing some new irrigation opportunities online for those areas in the last 20 years. Okay. So in conclusion, the land use program in Oregon has been successful at a high level in meeting the really high level objectives for the program of making growth efficient in terms of reducing costs for local government, in terms of making it easier to develop once lands are planned for urban uses, and in terms of conserving our farm and forest land. There are problems in the system, and The problems have to do with the complexity of the program, the fact that it's very difficult for citizens to understand and engage in major decisions because they are so complex. And we have a major set of bills that will come to your committee later in this session that propose a significant streamlining of the urban growth management part of the program that address directly some of the complexity, some of the frustration that's occurred at the local government level and among some of our citizens. So look forward to talking to you about that later in the session. And with that, I'm going to close and would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions for these gentlemen? Representative Davis.
I wonder if you could, thank you, first of all, for your testimony. I wonder if you could generally contrast Oregon's system with the way that other states have done land use planning. I know that we're known for being the trailblazer, so to speak. Washington has a very different system. California, just in broad strokes.
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, one thing I didn't mention at the beginning of my presentation, and a lot of this presentation came from work that we did for a program called Innovations in American Government. The Oregon Land Use Program was actually, and this is a very prestigious program run out of the Kennedy School. They choose one program nationally, and it's not, it's all types of government programs. The Oregon Land Use Program was selected as one of six finalists in the nation for that program out of 200 and something applicants a year ago. The reputation of Oregon's program nationally is that it is the leader, really, in terms of the effectiveness of the program in meeting the objectives that I just ran through. California's program relies very heavily on what's known as a little NEPA program. It has an environmental impact statement for development that occurs. So you don't have as much of an emphasis on upfront planning. You deal with projects as they come in the door. And that leads to significant frustration among both citizens and developers and a lot of uncertainty about what development is or is not going to occur. The state of Washington also has a little NEPA program. Washington has added in a growth management program in the last 15 years, and you see from the numbers up there that Washington has done better than Idaho and California, but still not nearly as well as Oregon in terms of making growth efficient and conserving farm and forest land. There are other models. A lot of states use market-based mechanisms to try to work with property owners to incentivize keeping lands in farm and forest use. This is something the department has been very active on in the last couple of years, and I know has a lot of interest in pursuing in the future in terms of some non-regulatory tools to really go to the next level in terms of achieving better results.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, you were talking about how we rank, Oregon's land use system ranks highly. What is this ranking? Who does the judging? Who, I mean, is this a panel of, I mean, who? Who's doing this?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, the ranking for the Innovations in American Government was done by a panel of national experts on various public programs. In terms of a formal ranking of land use programs in the nation, there is no formal ranking of land use programs. There are data that show how the states have been effective or not been effective in terms of efficiency of growth and conserving farm and forest land.
What was the name of that panel again? Something Innovations in Government?
Innovations in American Government. And Chair Clem, thanks. Representative Thatcher, I would be very happy to share those materials with you and the information about that program. There have been several other Oregon programs that have been finalists for that program as well. The Governor's Salmon Plan was a finalist about 10 years ago.
Any other questions for these gentlemen at this point?
So, Chair Clem, with your indulgence, we also have representatives from the Department of Forestry and the Department of Ag to give a little bit of more detailed perspective from their point of view about the land use program. And so we've got Doug Decker and the state forester and Jim Johnson, the land use specialist for the Oregon Department of Ag. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great. Come on up, gentlemen.
All right. Good afternoon, Representative Klett, members of the committee. My name is Doug Decker. I serve as Oregon State Forester, Director of the Department of Forestry. I've seen some of you this morning. Thanks for starting out this session by setting the table. I appreciate the opportunity to have Land Use 101 kind of setting the table for the weeks that we have ahead here. I want to just touch on the importance of the land use planning system to Oregon's forests. And as you saw in Richard's presentation, statewide planning goal 4 is around maintaining and protecting Oregon's primary forest lands. It is the highest priority for our Board of Forestry, our 7-member Board of Forestry, keeping working forests as working forests. It's right at the top of their list. And we really rely on the state's land use planning program to do that, to help achieve several goals, including first, maintaining the size of the forest land base, as Richard and Jim have shared. That also directly translates into maintaining the productivity of the forest land base, minimizing the cost of providing wildfire. You have to be in a different strategy when you're fighting fire in an area where there's development, reducing conflicts between commercial development, residential development, and forest management, as well as maintaining wildlife habitat. And these are all key elements that the land use planning system helps us deliver. I want to set the stage for why these goals are so important with some context here. Since the early 1970s, since land use planning came to Oregon, the area zone in western Oregon for residential and urban land use, those areas have increased, while the areas in forest land use classification have decreased, those from the planning standpoint. Right now, about 300,000 acres of Oregon's private forests, about 3% of the state's non-federal forest land, exist within urban growth boundaries. So that's 300,000 acres, about 3% of our 30 million acres of forest in Oregon are within urban growth boundaries or other development zones. So in our lifetimes, those lands will be converted to development during that time. So we recognize that. We know that those are the choices that we've made. If you look at statewide, there's about 1.8 million acres of non-federal forest land that exists within 1 mile of a residential or urban area. So you can begin to see the kind of compression and the issues that are there on our forests as we try to manage our growth and development. At the same time, our population base has shifted significantly. When our agency started out in 1911, we just turned 102 years old. There was about a 58% of Oregonians lived in rural areas, and 42% of them lived in urban areas. Today, that's flipped, and we have about 79% of all of our fellow citizens in an urban setting, 21% in a rural setting. So, and we know that since 1990, that Oregon's been one of those leading states in terms of population growth. Looking at the national level, there's been a pretty significant push on the conversion of private forests. About 1 million acres are converted every year, according to a study that the U.S. Forest Service has done, and they're expecting between now and 2030, about another 40 million acres are expected to be developed. That's nationally, so those are some of the national trends. And so the single most important factor in protecting the forest land base here that we have in Oregon is our land use planning system, plain and simple. The conversion of commercial forest land to urban and low-density residential uses has slowed dramatically. I have a handout that I've shared with you that kind of takes a look at that. And you can see where the charts kind of bottoms out there is when land use planning kicked in. And when you compare Oregon with other states, our system, as Richard has described, has been very, very successful. Over the last 35 years, we've experienced relatively small amount of development as compared certainly to Idaho to Washington and other western states. And again, I just want to emphasize the fact that when there is residential forest development, that it definitely increased the cost and the complexity of fighting fire there. Among other things, our agency, the Department of Forestry, we're Oregon's largest fire department. We provide fire protection on 16 million acres. And so we're very focused on maintaining and reducing the costs there in terms of reducing the costs of wildland fire protection, changes the tactics that we can use when we're fighting fire. We also have established that the cost of suppressing large wildfires increases as dwellings are threatened. It's about twice as expensive to fight a fire in the wildland-urban interface as it is in a kind of a wildland, a pure wildland setting. And that can be a problem. So you asked me to reflect on how the land use program creates issues, and I would say that you know, we believe the land use program prevents issues as it relates to the forest land base. Maybe another example would be that we've done some research that highlights the fact that when you reduce the parcel size or you increase the number of dwellings, the commercial productivity of those forest lands goes down. I've shared with you on the second page of the handout there a little chart that that describes that. At less than 20 people per square mile, which is about one house every 80 acres, the ability to conduct commercial forestry operations is about 75%. Good chance that you know we're going to be able to manage these lands when we're at that population density. You increase that to about 70 people per square mile, and that's about one house every 20 acres, and the commercial forestry aspect of that property is no longer viable. There's conflict there between residential and commercial use. I think that's part of it. There's the economy of scale of operations, complexity of safety and transportation really just reduce your ability to manage those lands. So it's important to keep these forest lands as working forest lands. You've asked me to talk a little bit about what I see, hoping to see in this session relative to land use. In addition to protecting the system that we have, we are interested in discussing some non-regulatory tools and incentives that can help us ensure that forest lands stay as working forest lands. Things like working forest easements, authorities that allow the appropriate transfer of development rights and other mechanisms. And we think that these tools and incentives could take a variety of forms that are utilized by nonprofit, public, and private sector organizations, including landowners. So interested in exploring those with you, with Richard, and with Jim, and with Jim in that conversation as we go through the session. Just in closing, I would ask you to think of me and my team. Our Deputy State Forester, Paul Bell, is here in the room. He's in the back of the room. You'll be seeing Paul and I quite a bit. And I hope that as we embark on the next 5 months that you'll look at us as sources of information and we can run down questions and ideas for you. So thank you very much.
Jim.
Representative Klim, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. On behalf of the department, first I'd like to send regards from Director Koba. She's back east at a Directors of Agriculture meeting and wish she could be here, but she cannot, so you get to have me, I guess. On behalf of the department, I'd first like to just really underline the importance that you've already heard of the real importance of the land use planning program in really sustaining the second largest industry in the state of Oregon. And you heard Mr. Whitman talk about traded sector and Oregon agriculture. 80% of the value of Oregon agriculture is achieved from sending agriculture out of the state of Oregon. That's traded sector, and that's an important element of the economy. You always hear about traded sector with the electronics industry. I like to point out that agriculture is a big part of the traded sector economy of the state of Oregon. Without that land base, though, that we depend on to grow all those products, and without the incursion of conflicting uses, we would lose this industry. So the land use planning program is really key towards maintaining and growing Oregon's agricultural industry. Mr. Whitman talked an awful lot about the role of land use and conserving agricultural lands and conversion and the like, and so I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. I'd be happy to answer questions later on that. What I really would like to do is focus on a couple of other issues that we see and that the Board of Agriculture sees. The Board of Agriculture, by the way, has a land use committee and discusses a lot of these issues also. That are really important to us. You hear a lot about urban growth, boundary expansions. You hear a lot about conversions of land or the like due to wholesale land use changes. But really, one of the areas that we're concerned about is the proliferation of non-farm uses in the exclusive farm use zone. When you look at the exclusive farm use zone, there are 23 land uses that are not farm use related that are basically in effect permitted outright subject to state statute in the exclusive farm use zone. There's another 27 land uses that can be allowed in an exclusive farm use zone subject to state statute and to local county code requirements, and in fact the counties could actually be more prohibitive if they'd like and not allow for those uses. So we're talking in the area or in excess of 50 plus non-farm uses that can be allowed into the exclusive farm use zone. It really gets to a cumulative impact issue, and it's not just the loss of land but the shadow that those uses cast on surrounding farming practices and the ability of these farmers to operate. I think it's cumulative impact is a really key term to keep in mind when you talk about that shadow and the incremental loss of lands bit by bit related to those shadows that are cast by non-farm uses. Of particular concern of late have been some non-farm uses that specifically serve urban residents, but the service is being provided on rural lands. So you look at things such as park facilities, event centers, some public facility type things, transmission lines and the like that are being sited on farmland, but they're serving urban populations, and a lot of times the conflicts associated with them are not necessarily taken into account the best way that would serve agriculture, even though that's where these uses are occurring. Historically, some of the key ones that some of you have heard about, I know that Representative Klim's heard about these because he and I have connected on a lot of these before, but energy facilities on exclusive farm use lands, you're hearing more and more of that. Of course, a lot of push for energy development, and rightfully so, but there are issues in terms of not just yes or no, but how, where, you know, should they be on the best farmland or should they be going on poorer farmland, for example. So the siting of energy facilities and transmission facilities, particularly these are long linear facilities that impact an awful lot of agricultural land. The perennial favorite, aggregate mining, but it is really becoming cumulatively more and more of an issue to the agricultural community because aggregate mining tends to occur, at least as it's been cited, on the best farmland in the state, Willamette Valley prime farmland and the like, and some of the issues there related to citing that and alternatives and the like are perennial issues and real issues that the ag community is dealing with. And more recently, a non-farm use area that's becoming more and more relationship between farm and non-farm use is agritourism, weddings, events, and all the conflicts associated with them in regard to commercial agricultural operations. The second area that the department is interested in, and I'll just relate to two specific uses, but they're related to definitional problems. When you look at the exclusive farm use zone and the like, there are an awful lot of terms or uses that really aren't defined, and so there's an awful lot of interpretation or discretion being used to interpret what kind of uses can be allowed there. And let me give you a couple of examples. Private parks. The exclusive farm use zone allows private parks, but it doesn't define what a private park is. So we are seeing some counties authorizing private parks to authorize events, weddings, other types of things, paintball situations and the like, under the guise of what is a private park. Without a definition, you know, that discretion interpretation may or may not be appropriate, but the agricultural community is concerned that some of those need to be defined, otherwise it's awful open-end on both ends. The other one that recently has become very problematic for the ag industry is the term, the use commercial activities in conjunction with farm use. Historically, that's been used to authorize things related to serving agriculture, agricultural infrastructure, implement dealers, farm machinery, storage facilities for grains, pesticide dealers, chemical dealers, food processing facilities, and the like. But due to some more recent court decisions, that term is being looked at much, much more broadly and has been used to authorize uses that are questionable in terms of their relationship to agriculture. And again, that term really hasn't been defined. There's case law on that and the such, but there's a lot of uncertainty related to what that means. So two examples in terms of definitions. There's a lot more that we deal with in terms of the exclusive farm use zones. I will say in relation to the events, the weddings, that type of stuff, the legislature did some very good work with Senate Bill 960 in 2011 to deal with some of that. It's getting there. There needs to be some more work, and there are people working on that to clarify that better and the like. And I think that in the situation of agritourism, it's important to recognize that that can help and keep agriculture viable, but there's ends to that, so to speak, to make sure that the tail's not wagging the dog. And so I think, Representative Clem, I'll end on that and just respond to any questions you may have.
So I have one. When you talked about legitimate examples of commercial activities in conjunction, like pesticide dealers and implement stores, what were some examples of ones that you think are more questionable?
Representative Clem, we've had some event-like elements approved as commercial uses in conjunction with farm use that have had no relationship whatsoever to any on-site agriculture, for example. So last time I checked, you don't really need to conduct weddings on your property to conduct your farming practices. So in conjunction with farm use, events are one of the areas where this is going. There's been some retail-type uses where somebody in the past has argued that it's a commercial use in conjunction with farm use because farmers buy the product. And, for example, the one I'm thinking of is U-Haul trucks. This is a commercial use in conjunction with farm use because farmers use U-Haul trucks. So does everybody else. It's not something that's essential to the practice of agriculture.
And would the, like, for example, a wedding, you're saying that would be more appropriate under what's allowed through 960, which is an event at a farmland rather than actually trying to, it's acknowledging it's not part of farming, but it's still an income stream for the farmer allowed under 960. That's a more appropriate place than trying to call it a in conjunction with farming activity.
Representative Clem, that's partially correct. There are weddings that may be associated, for example, at a winery, for example, where there's some relationship to that. It is better, I believe, better dealt with through a legislation such as what we did for the wineries or such as what we did with 960, recognizing that there's a relationship. But commercial uses in conjunction with farm use traditionally have been recognized as something that's essential to an agricultural practice, something that's really required. You know, a wedding's not essential to you know, conducting farming practices, but it may be appropriate or complementary.
Unless you're trying to marry your daughter off to a naive guy from Coos Bay who now thinks he's a farmer.
Well, that's not regulated, then it's not commercial.
And it works for free. Okay. Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, this question is going back to you.
Please.
On your chart that you had, trying to follow along with what Richard had said about since 1603, I think we still have 99% of our timber areas, but yet the private timber area in Oregon from 1953 to 97 fell by 30%.
Right, and so I think that Vice Chair Cameron, I think that this represents the lands that are classified, classified as forest land. So I think back in the 1600s, you know, the classification system wasn't there. So I think it's a classification as opposed to a development phenomenon. I think in actuality, if you look at some of the foothills of the Coast Range and the foothills of the Cascades, there's actually more trees on them now than there was 100 years ago.
So the comparison you're making here is not the same comparison that he would.
I would affirm what Richard has said, and I would basically say that I think what we're looking at here is those lands that are classified as forest lands versus lands that are growing trees, recognizing there's, there's a difference there.
Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Holding.
Thank you. I have a question for Doug as well. You had a comment about the cost of fire suppression in areas where you have urban residential use as well. And I wanted to clarify what drives that cost, because I thought it was the policy of, you know, the forestry that they are not there to protect the property. They are there to fight the fire of the forest. So what causes the large increase in areas where you do have residential uses, because it seems like you'd have water there and things like that. So.
Chair Clem, Representative Holby, the tactics that you are using when you're fighting fire in the wildland urban interface where there's homes and people and development, it's not uncommon for us in a wildland setting to be able to use fire to fight fire. And so you're fighting the fire in a much more constrained manner. The types of techniques that you would use in terms of doing burnout operations, of using helicopters and using air tankers, are not things that would be appropriate in a neighborhood or a near urban type of setting. Those tools are just not available to you, and as a result of that, you're putting more people, more equipment on the fire, and your costs are going up. And your ability to actually make a difference there is going down. I think, you know, further complicating that is the fact that, homes and structures and dwellings in forest land setting represent a different fuel complex. I mean, they're like slash piles in some ways when a fire gets moving in that area, and much more difficult to control.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry to lose people. I think that's it for you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, let's get the team Ag Forestry up here all at one time. We just have three left, right? Mm-hmm. So Katie and Jeff and Christina, do you all want to come up, or do you have multiple toting Ian? No. Christina, is it just you, or are you bringing anybody else?
Well, I was
going to
introduce Heath.
Well, you can do that. You want to wait, and I'll have Jeff and Katie go, and then you and Heath can come?
Oh.
Sure. Ian, are you sure you don't want to just come up here so we can haze you?
I can wait.
Oh, yeah, I can, yeah.
Thank you.
It's not your issue area. I'm surprised you're here even, you poor guy. And I know you are really thrilled to be getting this.
Thank you.
Yes, thank I'm just... Let's thank Sean Cleave right now. I'm sure he's watching for switching
Enjoying
teams.
Enjoying every minute of
yes.
this.
So whoever's first.
You're going to let me go?
He's an Oregon duck. I don't really want him here at all, but since he's here, go ahead and speak.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Stone. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I am not wearing my duck watch today to aggravate the chair, which I have done in numerous times before the chair in the past. I'm happy to actually talk to you about this issue. As a reminder, the nursery and greenhouse industry is your largest sector of ag, $722 million. We're number one on across the board on a number of issues. Our office of ACT resides in the district of Representative Davis. Most of our members, a lot of our members are in a lot of your districts. So as we talk about today, the nursery and greenhouse industry really does span the breadth of the Willamette Valley. So 75% of our product, as Mr. Johnson talked about, we are a traded sector. 75% of our product is shipped outside of the state of Oregon, 50% east of the Mississippi. So if you look at the geographic imprint of the nursery and greenhouse industry, we're big. In fact, we're the second largest nursery state in the country. California is number one. They get to be number one in anything that they would like to be. But we, by far, ship the most outside of our state borders. And so we have 54,000 acres, which may not seem like a lot, but those are very, very productive acres. And we're also, for the purpose of this discussion, we're both urban and rural. So a lot of nursery operations are close in to interchanges to get product to market. So when we talk about urban growth boundary expansions, oftentimes the areas that are first discussed are nursery lands because they're flat, they have services. And the fact is that we are also an economic engine. So when we talk about bringing other industries in, you are replacing one industry with another. So I'm not saying that those decisions have been poor. We've heard from Richard Whitman about how the system has worked. And I get to argue land use with John Chandler for a better part of two decades, so it's good for me. The last thing I would say is that there are other things that drive. I have extensive comments for you, which I'm not going to read to you, but other things in terms of land use that are really important to the nursery and greenhouse industry is access to water and transportation. Those two, for us, if we lose the ability to have the land that we have to do the things that we do, the ability to irrigate it, or the ability to ship it to market, your $722 million, which is down from $1 billion, which it was a couple years ago, but we're on the road to recovery, would not be the same type of industry. So if you think of us geographically from Boring down to past Representative Holvey's district, we're predominantly Willamette Valley. We are part of the stakeholder group that Richard Whitman mentioned. I feel for Richard trying to get all the stakeholders together. I feel like he's more like the Rolling Stones. You know, you can't always get what you want. You get what you need. And so that's the type of thing that we're going to try to work together. And I had a whole lot of other Rolling Stone metaphors I was going to use for you. But since my lobbyist is in attendance, I promised her I'd behave before you. So I have a lot of other things I could go over, but I'll you have a lot of people to get to, so I'll end my testimony now.
Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Glad to be here, a proud Oregon State grad. Like to add?
Yep. Much better.
So Oregon's land base is a building block for Oregon agriculture and us being productive and being the number two traded sector. Our land use planning system provides a framework that creates stability for the farming communities. And that's really the piece, is that it's a farming community where you have the farms, you have the suppliers, you have many times where you're marketing to, and to be able to move commodities and products through that system and have stability that the land uses in those areas are compatible is very critical for our success. Our EFU zones mitigate, for the most part, not always 100%, conflicts with non-farm uses. And part of the success of the system is kind of a three-way piece with the land use planning, our property tax laws and assessment rates that are very important where they're based on actually the farm value. And then also along with a strong right to farm and forest law as well. And so that interchangeability creates a very good framework for us to be successful under. You know, it's not perfect. I think Jim Johnson hit on several of the conflicts that we see within the current framework. One of those is allowance of quite a few non-farm uses in the EFU that can create conflicts between industries. One of that is the cumulative impact and what that can do to farmland prices in areas, especially when we're looking at trying to move an aging population and move those farms over to the next generation. The average age of a farmer is, you know, in the 60s, around 65 years old. And so it's important that we have the ability to move those operations on to the next generation. That may or may not be coming from a farming family. There is a lot of interest from non-farmers moving into that segment. Some non-farm conflicts that we're seeing that we believe need more discussion and some legislative work that I think Jim did not touch on, aggregate and conflicts between the aggregate industry on high-value farmland. We are concerned that in Willamette Valley there are not the adequate protections for our industry. Wetlands, as we see public conversions and purchases on wetlands, that is having an impact on farming in communities and the infrastructure there. Impacts on neighboring lands, where they are having an inability to continue to farm due to flooding issues and incapacity compatibility issues. And then the other one that we're hearing a lot of issues around is, which Jim touched on a little bit, is utility sightings, mainly on transmission lines, and that we're siting those transmission lines in the appropriate routes. Not sometimes A to B isn't the most route, you know, when you're looking at high-value farmland and the farming practices. I'm trying to put those where they mitigate those communities the least. And then the last piece I'd like to talk about is transportation infrastructure, which Jeff moved on. Our ability to move within the farm zone, but then also, as we're seeing the startup on farmers markets and more people selling and be able to move their product into the city, along with the port is one of our major export points where. So moving into Portland, access to roads from farm areas, from fields, from driveways, it is a critical issue, and being able to leave those access points open for farmers is a critical one, and I think something that will have more discussion this session as well. And so that transportation overlay with our land use system is very important for agriculture. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for these two?
All right, got off easy. Justin Martin, I know you want to come up and talk about land use and why you're here and who your clients are, and actually land use 102 for the next hour.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, good Super Bowl party, though.
Thank you.
So next we've got Christina and Heath.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. It appears to me that you have a series of somewhat reluctant witnesses this afternoon to speak to land use.
What's the deal?
I'd like to introduce Heath Curtis. He's new to OFIC and will be in front of you a lot this session as our general counsel and director of government affairs. I was asked to come and present this afternoon kind of a perspective on behalf of the forest industry of Oregon's land use program, and I'm going to kind of dive into a position statement that we've had for a while. I think we've heard a lot of good things today about the land use program, but it doesn't come without its challenges. First of all, I think we need to recognize that the land use laws are some of the most restrictive in the country, which is good and bad. Residential, commercial, and industrial development is generally allowed only inside a UGB, and in most cases, forest land lying outside those boundaries are restricted to forest use purposes. Alternative uses are largely prohibited by law, even if such purposes would generate a higher rate of return for the landowner. Although Oregon's land use program conceptually called for in the beginning for compensating landowners for lost property values, those funds were never appropriated for that purpose. And so I think understandably, Oregon's land use laws have been controversial and have been the subject of a series of ballot measures over the years, including statewide voter support requiring compensation for quote-unquote regulatory takings, or alternatively to require the government to waive restrictive regulations. The most recent statewide vote, though, largely reversed those property right initiatives. Despite all of these trade-offs, and they're significant, forest landowners in Oregon have generally supported land use laws. Intensive forest management, as you've heard already today, does not mix well with residential uses. In conflicts, and a heightened risk of forest fires are all inevitable if such mixed uses are encouraged. Nevertheless, Oregon's unique land use program creates some perverse effects for forest lands in particular. Through mechanisms like conservation easements and the sale of development rights, landowners in other states are paid for foregoing development alternative or opportunities. But because it's in state law, there's not the same value proposition, and we forego those opportunities for our landowners. So in a sense, the public gets the benefits of restricting private forest land in forest use at no charge, while the private forest landowners cannot pursue a higher and better use for their lands. Meanwhile, forest practices are heavily regulated in Oregon with the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which I'm proud to say we supported first in the nation 2 years before the land use was passed in Oregon. But these do also have substantial costs for forest landowners, and their competitors, our competitors in the southeast of this country and elsewhere, don't have to bear those costs. So ultimately, if it's a state policy objective to keep working forest land in a forest land base, and I want to emphasize the word working, we have to maintain the forest landowner support for Oregon's land use laws. And it's important that those lands can be managed profitably and efficiently for that purpose. So I just want to bring to your attention some sensitivities we have in the forest industry. Regulations under the Forest Practices Act, and we support the Forest Practices Act, but they need to remain science-based, reasonable, and achievable. And as seen in some neighboring states, Washington and California in particular, excessive regulation of forest practices has been a primary factor in the rapid conversion of forest lands to non-forest uses. And another thought, while many members of OFIC are multi-generational, family-held private companies, which is also unique to Oregon, some are organized as REITs and TIMOs. These are sophisticated ownership interests, and above all, they're very fluid. Regulatory certainty and stability is imperative for continued investment in a long-term asset such as trees. As you consider policies before this committee, I'd ask that you consider the perspective of the forest landowner. Will this policy increase regulatory certainty or add complexity around management issues? Will it increase operational costs? Will it add to or subtract from asset value? When timberland is highly valued by generations of families and by investors alike, it attracts the best stewards of our state's natural resources, those that will ensure the land base is well maintained, continues to provide ecosystem services such as clean air and water, carbon sequestration, wildlife habitat, and recreational activities. So I really do appreciate the opportunity to kind of share our thoughts about land use and look forward to continued engagement this session. Primarily, I think, with Heath.
Heath, do you have anything to say for yourself there? What do you got?
I think my job was to sit here and let you look at me for this.
And answer questions.
That's right. Well, welcome and welcome to Oregon's capital. I know you have a lot of experience around the country, but welcome.
Thank you so much, you. Chair Clint.
Any questions for our friends from Timber? Okay.
Thank you.
So that is the end of our panel. And just to give folks on the committee, since I have been traveling since the last few weeks, I haven't had a chance to call or really talk to any of you. You know, this was obviously focused mostly on industries outside the UGB. And my hope, kind of like Director Whitman's, is some of the reputation of the land use committee start to go away, or land use issues start to go away as divisive and nasty, and try and focus on things. So like, this is the one time you're going to hear a lot from me, at least, about outside the UGB activities. And most of the rest of the time, I'm going to want to work on how to make things work for development inside the UGB. And there's a lot of fertile ground to be plowed there. And the friends of mine who want to engage in battles about how to further tighten things outside the UGB are going to get a lot of no's, and the people who want to open up a lot of things outside the UGB are going to get a lot of no's, and I think you're going to find this a relatively 2011-like committee where it's largely a co-governance sort of structure, even though that's not in the rules. You're going to find not a lot of controversy in this committee due to the kind of decisions I make about what bills will move and what won't move. Having said that, that hopefully will be refreshing for all those pained looks when you had to walk in here today. Some people will certainly be disappointed by that as well, but I figure we could talk about this again in 2 years if we really want to fight about all the old land use battles. And having said that, I will adjourn the committee.